From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Amanda Petrusich is my guest. Amanda Petrusich is the author of It Still Moves, Lost Songs, Lost Highways, and the Search for the Next American Music. She's also the author of the Nick Drake Pink Moon volume of the 33 and a Third series. I love those. She's a contributor to Pitchfork and has written for the New York Times, The Atlantic, Spin, BuzzFeed, and lots of other places. Her new book is Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 Records. Amanda Petrusich, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when I was reading your book, I was thinking of Father Damien, you know, the guy who went to treat the lepers and then came down with leprosy.
Right. Fair enough, yes.
So you set out to write a chronicle of obsessive collectors, and you became an obsessive collector.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a sort of rich and fantastic history of, you know, that kind of immersion journalism from George Plimpton, you know, on up. But it wasn't really what I set out to do. I mean, it wasn't my intention to kind of... I didn't realize that the book I would be writing would be so much about myself and my own sort of... you know, examination of fandom and of music and sort of why it works on me and kind of what I want and what feels good. But it very much became that story. And yeah, absolutely, by the end of the book, and even now, I you know, became really dedicated to this format and also this way of listening to records and listening to music.
So even though you're done writing the book, you're still obsessively collecting?
Yeah, I'm sad to report that unfortunately I couldn't kind of, you know, close. I would love to think I could just sort of close my laptop and stand up and brush myself off and move on. No, it did change me as a listener, and again as a fan. You know, the experience of listening. I mean, 78s contain about 2 to 3 minutes of music each side, and people talk about the experience of listening to a vinyl record and how it's a sort of tactile process that forces you to focus your intention in a really particular way, and I found 78s were an even more dramatic iteration of that. There's really nothing else to do while you're listening to a 78 except sort of be present with it and you know, let it affect you or not, but it was, you know, it felt like a really clear and sort of direct pathway, and I think heading into the reporting of this book, I really feared that I'd lost that as a listener.
Yeah, well, when you're listening to an album, you have 20 minutes, you could go do something, but when you're listening to a 78, there's nothing to do but sit there and watch it spin around, because by the time you're doing something, it's time to take it off and put another one on.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and the sort of energy and commitment and finances and sort of thought that gets funneled into the hunt for these records and for the rare ones in particular, you know, I mean, it's such a huge investment of time that, you know, the payoff of getting to sit down with this thing for 2 to 3 minutes and, you know, get to hear a song you've never heard before, or get to hear a song you've heard before but never in this way.
Yeah, never the pure, right off the vinyl, rather than hear it as an MP3 or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, that was transformative in surprising ways. I think I'd kind of protected myself in a way from being overly romantic about the format or being overly nostalgic about the format, and then it just caught me off guard, and I, yeah, got kind of seduced utterly.
See, like, I don't understand the obsessive collecting thing, because the only things that I have ever collected obsessively were comic books and toys and records and books and DVDs and big little books, Charlie McCarthy spoons and magazines and old radios. Old telephones, horse tack, Coca-Cola trays, baseball cards, Beatle cards, just and a couple of other dozen things, swizzle
sure.
sticks. But other
yeah.
than that, I've never collected obsessively.
So a collection of collections, it sounds like there.
So I do totally understand the obsessive collecting thing. And in fact, I collect 78 records. But see, I don't think anybody would want my 78s because mine are... what did you call them? They're common.
Right.
You know, like, I like Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and Perry Como.
Sure. Well, now I sound like such a snob. Yes, of course. Those 78s are, you know, they were popular, and so they were produced in mass quantities, and they were sold and distributed widely, and you know, consequently, they're not that difficult to find now, so they hold less cachet for serious collectors. But of course, I mean, in my favorite collections of records, and this goes for 78s and, you know, and LPs and books, and my favorite collections of anything really are the collections that feel really personal, that feel like, you know, a sort of flawed and idiosyncratic reflection of the self in a way, where you can look at someone's shelf, you know, their bookshelf, for example, and say, like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. I kind of get maybe who you are, who you want to be, or who you were, that there is some, you know, sense of character and of identity, you know, in the objects themselves and in their serialization. So, yeah, absolutely, those records are not super rare and maybe less expensive, but I think just as worthwhile to have them around.
Thank you for validating me, Amanda Petrosic.
Not that you need it.
Well, you know, I have been accused of hoarding, which is total nonsense. But tell us, what's the difference between hoarding and collecting?
Sure. Well, there is a scientist or a, you know, MD could probably tell you the precise. There are clinical definitions, maybe not biomarkers exactly, but there are, you know, diagnostic criteria that define the two. But for me, the thing that really surprised me going into this book is I thought, okay, I'm going to write this thing about obsessive collectors of records, and I'm going to get to spend time among men, and they're almost always men who have thousands and thousands and thousands of records. And that turned out to not be true for 78 collectors. It wasn't so much about the quantities of stuff as it was about the relative quality or the relative rareness of the performances that they had amassed. So I think that's one difference, is that 78 collectors at least are incredibly discerning. I mean, they're very particular about what they want in their collections. They're not interested in things that don't fit into that rubric. So it's not just about buying up every 78 they see. It's about making a really, really curated and often very complex collection of objects.
But then, of course, obsessing and wondering about the one that you didn't get, and maybe you should have gotten that one.
Oh, yeah. Every collector has that story. I mean, you know, it's funny interviewing collectors for so long. You start to hear the language that gets used, the way that they speak about their collections or the ones that got away. I mean, it's romantic language. It sounds like people talking about lost lovers, you know, or ex-boyfriends or ex-girlfriends, ex-partners. You start to hear that particular kind of longing and that particular kind of sadness that, you know, it feels like heartache. I mean, I think that they feel those losses palpably, and they feel them deeply, and it's both beautiful and intense, actually, to talk to a collector about all those things that they missed out on. And you know, I've felt that too. Everybody feels, you know those pangs of regret, something you wish you'd picked up when you were on vacation, a souvenir that you didn't get, and now you feel like you can't ever get it, and it sort of haunts you. Yeah, absolutely. Every collector's got a great story about the one that got away.
You talk a lot about the motivations for collecting and do not sell at any price. But, you know, I always thought that there was kind of a sexual aspect of collecting. That is, collecting or having an impressive collection would make a collector like me more attractive to the opposite sex.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. It was a thing I certainly thought about. It's a thing that we see reflected, and this is not a perfect parallel, but we see it reflected in nature a little bit. I mean, you'll see animals like crows, for example, that will, you know, collect a bunch of shiny stuff and put it in their nest, and it helps them attract a mate. I mean, speaking personally, I find it to be an attractive thing. If you meet someone, you sort of go home and see their stuff, and it's stuff that you think is cool, that feels aspirational or interesting or compelling to you. I think you hope that it communicates something about the person that owns it. That's sort of the, you know, your best case scenario. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's also something with 78s in particular. I'm almost embarrassed to talk about this, but there's something sort of sexy about them. They're sort of sexy objects. They're mysterious and they're ancient, and they have these kind of very intense, very raw sort of mystical performances contained therein. I mean, even the act, if I may be very base for a moment, even the act of sort of dropping a needle into a groove. There's a little. Right?
Yeah, it's an image for sure of something going into. It's not quite like, hot dogs chasing donuts through the Lincoln Tunnel, but it's something
right.
like that.
Right.
We're talking to Amanda Petrosic, and her new book is called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 Records. And Amanda got very wild and obsessive. I mean, you learned how to scuba dive so that you could dig through the bottom of the river to see if you could find some masters that had been tossed in there.
Yeah, that is probably the apex, or perhaps the nadir, of my own particular journey into this world. I'd become, as many sort of starting out collectors do, I'd become sort of obsessed with the story of this label called Paramount Records, which was a blues label based out of Port Washington and Grafton, Wisconsin, that had sort of accidentally recorded some of what, to my ears at least, were, you know, the greatest and most sort of devastating and moving pre-war country blues performances in American history. And, you know, they've kind of backed into this Race record series that they launched in the 20s. And when the company eventually closed down, as many record companies did in the 40s because of the Depression, there was this mythology that the employees of Paramount Records were so disgruntled that they had been laid off that they hurled all the remaining dead stock of their 78s, so all the pressed and packaged 78s that hadn't been yet shipped out for distribution, and also some of the metal masters, so the stampers of the recording sessions that were used to press the 78s, that all of that stuff had just gotten frisbeed into the Milwaukee River. And had been, you know, sitting there rotting at the bottom of the river for the last, you know, 70 or 80 years. So I became really, really very interested in that idea, and that idea that maybe that stuff was down there. And even though I knew kind of logically it would be unlistenable at this point in time, there was part of me that I think both just wanted to know if it was there and then also wanted to find a way to sort of get closer to Paramount and to some of the work that they were doing. There's very little evidence left in Grafton now that there was ever this recording studio there or this pressing plant. There's like a bit of a crumbling foundation, and then there are, you know, the records themselves, the Paramount 78s, that you can, if you are very lucky, hunt down and find. But it felt like this sort of weird moment in American history that kind of, you know, in a poof had disappeared. And I think I thought if I could learn how to scuba dive, which was a colossal misadventure for me, and get to the bottom of that river, that maybe I could figure some of that out. It felt like a literal baptism in a way.
And so you did. You went down there and you dug through the mud and you found them, the holy grail of Paramount Records, right?
Yeah, I wish I could say I emerged holding, you know, the missing Willie Brown 78 or some, you know, never before heard Skip James record. No, it's very inadvised. I would not advise any of your listeners to attempt to scuba dive, probably in any river, but particularly in the Milwaukee River. It's cold and it's very muddy and you can't see anything, and it's, you know, it's nearly impossible to find it. It's also a very strong current and it's a bit tricky to navigate. The river's very shallow in parts. Yes, it was a sort of misinformed adventure, but a thing that I'm glad I did. I'm glad I sort of indulged my mania in that particular case.
Well, it made it a good chapter in your story. But
true,
but then did you have like this rude awakening? Like, what's happened to me?
Oh God, yes, I'm still having that. still having that kind of awakening. In fact, yeah, certainly. I mean, I felt myself really sort of, you know, falling down the rabbit hole, as you said, many times throughout the course of reporting this story, and had to sort of remind myself of what I was doing there in the first place, that I had kind of parachuted in to, you know, come back with a dispatch on the subculture and not necessarily to be subsumed by it. But it was hard. I think it was harder and harder the more time I spent among these guys, and the more I got access to their records, the more I found myself wanting them. I mean, just really, it started to feel very high stakes to me and very important that I acquire some of these songs.
Now, a lot of the collectors that you talk about in your book, or I remember one specifically who doesn't think any music recorded after, you know, 1958 was worth listening to. These guys are really into the music that they're into, and that's the only music that they're interested in, or the only music that they even think is valid. Whereas you're a person who has been a music journalist and came to music journalism through a love of music, a variety of different kinds of music. You wrote about Nick Drake, as I heard you interviewing Liz Phair. I mean, you love all kinds of music. Is that still happening with you? Or are you now just, that was recorded after 58, I'm not interested?
No, that was... it was a point of contention for me with collectors throughout the reporting of the book, and certainly remains that way now. I mean, I was born in 1980 and sort of came of age in the citadel of grunge in a way. And, you know, my first love was punk and hardcore music. I loved The Clash as a kid. I kind of came into indie rock a little bit later. But now, as an adult and certainly as a critic, you know, I'm a big fan of a lot of contemporary pop music. I think there's really exciting things being made now, exciting records being made, you know, really important artists working now. And I could never really convey that. I mean, we would bicker about it all the time, and I could never really get collectors to sort of feel similarly about modern music. There was some sense of yeah, there was a line in the sand, and I think 1958 is actually probably a generous cutoff. I think a lot of these guys, not, you know, if it's not pre-war, I think 1940 is often the cutoff for many of them.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I,
we don't
know,
like
I
these modern singers like Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's true, you know, or the Beatles. I mean, they think all that stuff is nonsense. You know, and to an extent, I understand when you've spent that much time with the source material, with the raw material, everything else sounds derivative to you in a way that is distracting or silly. There's also something I think about pre-war performances, and this was the point I finally conceded to them. There's something about the way people used to sing in a recording studio, I think, before they were really aware of what was happening. I mean, or weren't quite aware of the fact that they were making an artifact that could endure for the next 100 years, the next 500 years. There was a sort of unself-consciousness, I think, to the way people performed then. But I do agree, I don't hear that as much or as routinely in music now, and it is a really appealing thing. It's very human. It can feel very raw and almost feral sounding. And I understand if you've been listening for that and that's the thing that you want, it's harder to find in records now. I don't think you can't find it, but I did finally concede that there is something about the way people sang in particular in those early years of the recording industry that we maybe don't hear as much of now.
Well, I mean, think about how up until Edison, any performance of any kind was ephemeral and gone forever. So the fact that it suddenly could be saved for a little while didn't occur to them that would mean that it would be saved forever.
Right. I mean, it's inconceivable in a way. You can understand why it would be, it wouldn't even sort of occur to you, this idea that, you know, you were making this object that would become this sort of physical record of this particular moment in time. It's a kind of a big concept. I mean, it's, you know, it makes my head spin even now, and I can only imagine how a person would have felt about it in the first few decades of the 20th century. So it's, yeah, I mean, there was this huge kind of seismic cultural shift in the way that we thought about music prior to Edison. You know, music was a thing you encountered live, and as you said, yeah, it was there, and then it was gone, and you remembered it, or you didn't, but there was no
recording of it, right.
No, yeah, exactly.
You not only did you not hear music in elevators, but there wasn't even an elevator.
Yeah. It's true.
But you know, the thing is, and the other thing about that is that almost any time something new comes along, the thing that was old is completely discarded. Like when talking films came in, silent films were totally discarded for a long time. And when LPs came in, 78s were completely discarded. And now, in this era of the internet, there's like nothing that is rare, nothing that is obscure, because everybody knows everything, everybody has everything instantly. So these are things that you can't put on your phone, or you can't delete them.
Yeah, you really can't. I mean, I suppose you could put an MP3 of you know, Devil Got My Woman on your phone now, but the experience is so different. I mean, and that was a thing, you know, I was wary of kind of prizing rarity as an end in and of itself, or as, you know, a thing to sort of seek out, or to let it trump, you know, the relative quality of a song or of a performance or its emotional, you know, work. But there is something about that, about the experience of really seeking out a record, of, you know, spending, again, all that sort of time and energy and money and, you know, emotional work to find something, and then to allow it to mean something to you. I mean, I suspect, like many of your listeners, I feel, you know, when I open Spotify or even open my iTunes library, which is a finite library, I feel overwhelmed by all the stuff I have access to. It's certainly a great gift, you know, and we live in an extraordinary moment in terms of access. But it can be paralyzing, I think, all of those choices.
There's so much to listen to, I'm not going to listen to anything. You talked right. A little bit about, in your book, about how free CDs come to you all the time because you're a journalist. And actually, the same thing happens to me. I get free books all the time. And, you know, after a while, there's just like this mountain of things, and you just have to put them in a bag and give them away because you don't have room for all of them in your house. And even though there might be something, you know, phenomenal in there, there's only so much time. You can only listen to so many things, watch so many things, read so many things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at first that wealth, it sounds so fun. You know, I mean, it sounds like the greatest thing that could have ever happen to a music fan or to a, you know, voracious reader, to have this endless stream of product. But it does, at least for me, and it sounds like for you too, it kind of started to devalue the whole thing, not just the idea of music as a material object, but music itself and the experience of listening, the whole thing just sort of kept getting cheapened and cheapened and cheapened until I personally at least felt like I wasn't listening well, I wasn't listening thoughtfully, I wasn't investing in art the way that I wanted to or the way that I used to when I was younger.
So you heard some things. We're talking with Amanda Petrusich, and her new book is called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 Records. And you heard some of these records, and you actually felt like some songs changed your life.
Yeah, absolutely. It was there were a few things that I had never heard before, or hadn't heard, certainly many things I had never heard on 78 prior to the reporting of the book. And there were a couple tracks in particular that just, I don't know, devastated me, that sort of did their emotional work on me in a way that I wasn't expecting. One of them was by a Cajun singer named Blind Uncle Gaspard, who had recorded a few tracks, probably 7 or 8, I guess it would have been 8, for Vocalion Records in the late 1920s. And he had a song included on Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music, and I'd heard that song before, but the particular 78 that sort of turned everything upside down for me was a song called Sur le Bord de l'eau, or On the Water's Edge. And Blind Uncle Gaspard is a Cajun singer, and he sings in French. He was from Louisiana. I have no idea what he's talking about. I don't speak French, and I especially don't speak sort of idiomatic Creole French that he was singing in. And he plays guitar, and it was just one of the most haunting, almost terrifying performances I had ever heard. It's incredibly sad. His voice is imbued with this sort of deep and intense longing. And I had no context for the record. All I knew was that this was a guy who recorded a few songs in the 20s. He was from Louisiana. He was a Cajun performer. That was it. I didn't know anything else about him. And that felt, that in and of itself felt like a gift. Sort of being denied that context allowed me to kind of have a relationship with that song that I'm not sure I would be able to have with a song today that I, you know, I'm able to know so much about. I can look up the artist and look at their Instagram and see what they ate for breakfast. And, you know, it's a really different experience of fandom now. And it's not even so much that I think one is better than the other. It's just that it was so new for me, and it felt so good. It felt so good to do that work, to sort of do the work of loving a song on its own terms exclusively. And that certainly changed for me the way that I listen.
I go to me from end to the Lord of Morjadet. To Lord of Morjadet to the Bordenil. To Lord of Morjadet to the Bordenil. To the Bordenil. Ma perçois d'une belle de 30 mortelots. Je m'aperçois d'une belle de 30 mortelots. De 30 mortelots de le bord de Nil. Les deux plus jeunes de 30 chantent une chanson, chantent une chanson sur le bord du Nil, chantent une chanson sur le bord de l'eau, sur le bord d'un vaisseau. Mes chansons qu'il chante, j'aimerais la savoir. Ma belle chanson qu'il chante, j'aimerais la savoir. J'aimerais la savoir sur le bord du Nil. J'aimerais la savoir sur le bord de l'eau, sur le bord d'un vaisseau. Ma belle, rentrez dans ma barre, je vous la montrerai. Ma belle, rentrez dans ma barre, je vous la montrerai. Je vous la montrerai sur le bord de l'île. Je vous la montrerai sur le bord de l'eau, sur le bord d'un vaisseau. La belle suite en bâtie est mise à pleurer. Est mise à pleurer sur le bord du Nil. Est mise à pleurer sur le bord de l'eau.
It's so many of these artists are ciphers in a way. There's so few facts that we know about their lives, and they're quite mysterious. And of course, the act of listening to a 78 again, it's shrouded in crackle, and you know, there's something mysterious about these emanations from, you know, decades and decades and decades ago that we're just getting to hear now. I mean, the whole process is very sort of spooky in its way, but. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so little that we know about these performers. And the small bits of information that we do have were often sussed out or researched or acquired by 78 collectors. You know, it wasn't historians or academics or, you know, ethnomusicologists. It was more often than not, it was a collector that managed to figure out, you know, where a person was born or where a performer died or, you know, this sort of sparse facts we may know about their lives. Almost all of that information comes from 78 collectors.
Yeah, you talked a lot about Harry Smith in your book. He lived in the Chelsea Hotel, and he compiled those brilliant records of 78s that he collected. And yeah. you talked about his collection and what happened to it after his life, and that was kind of a frightening. I mean, what do we do? What happens to our collections, you know, those of us who are...
I think that there's a collector in the book that actually refers to his collection as a two-ton albatross. because, you know, 78s are very heavy and they take up a lot of space. And it's a lot of work to sort of maintain a collection and keep it in good shape. And certainly if a collector passes away and, you know, his estate has to sort of contend with it, finding the right buyers for things, it's also incredibly complicated. The whole economy and the way that subculture works and sort of what people will pay for things and who wants what and who feels entitled to what, it's a mess. So collectors will often leave really detailed descriptions for their survivors in a way of what they want to happen to their records, but those things are not always heeded, and often there are stories. Harry Smith is a good one. There's another collector featured in the book, a younger collector named Nathan Salzberg, who's also the curator of the Alamo Max Archive, and he lives in Louisville, Kentucky, and sort of had the incredible fortune, or I suppose some would say misfortune, of stumbling into several thousand 78s in a dumpster in Louisville. And it was a collector named Don Wall who had died and was estranged from his family, and they wanted very little to do with him. I think that the county had to issue a next of kin order, and they finally just decided to, you know, bulldoze basically the contents of his house. Everything was getting thrown away, including his record collection. He was a very serious collector of 78s, and you know, Nathan just happened to be in the right place at the right time and sort of inherited all of these records and, you know, pulled them out of the dumpster and saved and digitized and cleaned them up and eventually released them commercially. He did a fantastic box set with Tompkins Square of some of the Wall material. But that's a common story. You know, a collector becomes estranged from people in his life and then, you know, dies and his collection gets thrown out or gets sort of deserialized in one way or another, gets split up, gets moved around, gets donated to a library where it sort of languishes in boxes. There's a lot of sad stories like that, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't want that to happen, so I'm making sure that all my 78s go to you, Amanda.
Yeah. I'll take them.
So maybe. Get ready for some Perry Como 78s. They're coming your way. The book is called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78, RPM Records. And the author, the brilliant Amanda Petrusich, thank you for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com, where you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Amanda Petrusich. Her new book, Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.